It's 1946 in New York. A chauffeur steers a long black car toward IBM headquarters at 590 Madison Avenue. In the back sits Thomas Watson Sr., lanky, impatient, and at age 72, he often finds he can't muster the energy he'd long brought to his job. Watson has reigned as chief executive of IBM for 30 years. As the car pulls up, he can see the words International Business Machines in all capital letters spread across the front of the building. Once inside, Watson passes through an airy first-floor showroom. It's open to the public and displays IBM's state-of-the-art punch card machines, the metallic mechanical contraptions that process data for governments, corporations, and railways. Watson basically invented the information industry, and IBM dominates it. He is one of the best-known executives in the world. On his way to the elevators, IBM employees greet him as he passes. Good morning, Mr. Watson. Welcome, Mr. Watson. He rides the elevator to the 17th floor and steps off into an elegant central hallway, paneled in oak with black and white marble floors. As Watson walks to his office door, five male secretaries greet him. Most of Watson's contemporaries in other companies employ women as secretaries. Watson believes that is a mistake. Pretty young woman secretaries are distracting. If you want to be successful, Watson tells his executives, you must have male secretaries. He is superstitious about sticking with what works, and since Watson has been successful and has always had male secretaries, in his mind, there's a link. From the door of his office, Watson crosses 30 feet of deep pile blue carpet to his desk. The corner windows offer a view of the East River and the Queensboro Bridge, except that Watson almost always keeps the red velvet drapes closed. His mahogany desk is heaped with papers. He has no interest in keeping his papers orderly. Between the piles of paper are family photographs and a chrome paperweight that says Reflexion, the French version of IBM's now famous motto, Think. Above him hang signed photographs of famous people, including politicians, entertainers, and businessmen. This is an office designed to intimidate, and he definitely wants to intimidate his next guests, the inventors of the world's first electronic computer, called the ENIAC. One of Watson's secretaries announces that his next meeting, a physicist and an electrical engineer, have arrived. Mr. Watson, Mr. J. Presper Eckert, and Mr. John Mockley are here to see you. Now, Watson has never met either Eckert or Mockley, but even before they walk in the door, the IBM CEO mutters that he wants to ruin them. None of the participants understand just how much this meeting will change history. From Wondery, this is Business Wars. I'm David Brown. In our last episode of the First Computer Wars, Americans who had adopted that wonder of modern technology, the television, watched as the UNIVAC computer correctly predicted the outcome of the 1952 presidential election. That moment laid the groundwork for a coming technological breakthrough that most people could not even fathom at the time. It escalated a running battle into an all-out war between two rivals, James Rand, whose company made the UNIVAC, and his chief competitor, Thomas Watson Sr., the man who built IBM. In this episode, the battle over electronic computing shifts to a clash between Watson Sr. and his younger namesake. This is episode 2 in our 6-part series, Father, Son, and the Future. And you can listen to the first 4 episodes of this new series ad-free right now by subscribing to Wondery Plus. Let's go back to 1946. 6 years before election night, there was a moment, a meeting, in Thomas Watson's office that he would fumble. He would later regret the outcome dearly. His secretary ushers in the two engineers turned entrepreneurs, Eckert and Mockley, who haltingly cross the threshold into Watson's elegant office. J. Presper Eckert is tall and gangly. He wears glasses and looks every bit the part of an academic. John Mockley is shorter and balding and looks more like a salesman. Until recently, they were both professors of engineering. Their rumpled dress stands out against the sea of formally attired IBM employees. Watson is famous for making his employees wear crisp white shirts and dark suits at all times. It's the IBM dress code. During World War II, Eckert and Mockley had worked at the University of Pennsylvania. The U.S. military funded them to do research on a promising new technology called electronic computing. The professors built the world's first electronic computer called the ENIAC. It was classified as a secret during the war, but IBM had heard rumors. Just after the war ended, Watson sent his son Thomas Watson Jr. to the university to determine whether that project might wind up being a threat to IBM. A few months earlier, Eckert led Watson Jr. and Charlie Kirk, another IBM employee, into a room made oppressively hot by ENIAC's 18,000 lit vacuum tubes. Eckert, cocky and impetuous, explained how ENIAC works. Electronic computers are going to replace the electromechanical machines like IBM's. I don't know if you realize it, but the new electronic computer will be able to process data 1,000 times faster than your most sophisticated tabulating machines. That sounds very impressive, but not very practical. Your machine costs too much to build, and it's unreliable. How would a business do critical work if tubes keep burning out and shutting down the machine? It was an epic failure of imagination. When Watson Jr. and Kirk report back to the elder Watson, they conclude that the professors are just big dreamers, not a real threat to IBM. But soon after Watson Jr.'s visit, Eckert and Mockley resign from the university. They want to turn ENIAC into a business. The university refuses to go along, and eventually the duo are pushed out. So now, they've come to Watson Sr.'s enormous office to ask IBM for help. Watson Jr. and Kirk join the meeting. After polite chit-chat, the elder Watson takes charge of the conversation, seeing a way to both co-opt and, if necessary, neutralize the ENIAC pair.
"I've got an offer for you men. It will be almost impossible for you to build an independent business. Now, I'd like you to work for IBM and start an electronic computing laboratory. Now, I'll make sure it's well-financed so you can continue your important research."
"Well, that's a kind offer, Mr. Watson, but we are a business. If you want us to join IBM, we'd want you to buy our business and then bring us into the company."
"I don't see it that way. You men are scientists. Your machine is an experiment. You have no business. If those are the terms, I'm not interested."
Watson calls in one of the secretaries to help rush Eckert and Mockley out the door. As soon as they leave, Watson chuckles dismissively and turns to Watson Jr. and Kirk.
"This guy Mockley wears these loud socks. I wouldn't want him in my business anyway."
Watson, though, isn't entirely unconcerned. After the meeting, he tells his son and Kirk that he wants to know about anything IBM might be working on that's similar to ENIAC. They remind Watson Sr. that during the war, IBM actually shut down any research on electronics. But there is one project. A passionate young IBM engineer named Halsey Dickinson has been working on vacuum tube electronics in his home basement. He's also trying to work inconspicuously on a prototype electronic calculator in a corner of one of IBM's labs. Now Watson Sr. wants to see it. They find Halsey Dickinson in a noisy engineering lab, staring at one of IBM's high-speed punch card readers connected to a mysterious-looking black box about 4 feet tall.
"Mr. Dickinson, can you show us what you've been working on there?"
"Yes, Mr. Watson. Inside this box are radio tubes. The tubes switch on and off to make calculations, just like our tabulating machines. But these tubes don't have any moving parts, so they can switch on and off much, much faster than mechanical switches."
"I see. Now, why does the punch card reader keep working while the box seems to stop from time to time?"
The box is waiting for the cards to catch up. The electronics spend 9/10 of their time waiting for the punch card mechanism, and it's the fastest punch card machine we've got.
Watson appears interested, maybe even mildly impressed. But what the old man also sees is a machine that could make IBM's enormously successful existing product line obsolete. And that would threaten his legacy as one of the great industrialists. But the young Tom Watson Jr. sees it differently. He suddenly sees a phenomenal opportunity, both for IBM and for himself. Watson Jr. knows that what he is coming to realize will pit him against his father. So, he has to wait for the right moment. As a seasoned yachtsman, an excellent skier, and a passionate pilot of gliders and biplanes, he understands the importance of timing. That moment comes the following year, during a meeting in his father's office between Watson Jr. and Sr. and Frank Hamilton, one of IBM's top engineers. Watson Sr. shoves a newspaper clipping across his desk to Hamilton. It's an August 25, 1947 story from the New York Herald Tribune. Watson Jr. sees the scowl on his father's face. Hamilton looks pensive. Watson Jr. leans over the desk so he can read the story out loud.
The U.S. government plans to set up and fund two separate laboratories for building two ultra-high-speed electronic computing machines that will be faster and better than any previous device.
Read the second paragraph, the second one, where it says private companies will build the machines in cooperation with the government. See any interesting names there?
Raytheon Corporation. That's a little surprising. And, oh, for God's sakes, Electronic Control Company. That's Eckert and Mauchly, the ENIAC men.
Precisely. The government wants to make sure an American company keeps the worldwide lead in computing. So it's funding our competition. After all I did for the war effort, IBM won't stand still for this.
Tom Watson Jr. sees the opening with his father, but he has to be careful. Watson Jr. is dashingly handsome at 33 years old. He clashes often with his father about electronics. Watson Jr. wants IBM to move fast. Watson Sr., still very much in charge, is more interested in protecting IBM's existing technology of tabulating machines. Up to this point, all Watson Jr. has managed to convince his father to test in the marketplace is a lightweight electronic machine. The ENIAC did its calculations with 18,000 tubes. The IBM 603 electronic multiplier has just 300. It can't do much more than multiply 2 6-digit numbers read from a punch card. But it could do that multiplication 10 times faster than anything else on the market. The elder Watson was actually astonished when customers liked the 603 and placed orders for it. It was a small success compared to the mountains of revenue generated by IBM's traditional machines, but it was a notch in the belt for Tom Watson Jr. It helped convince his father to fund a grander experiment, the Selective Sequence Electronic Calculator, known as the SSEC. But even the SSEC is little more than a cautious hedge for IBM. It's not a real electronic computer. What the IBM engineers are concocting is a mix of electronics and old punch card machines. The information is still stored on the punch cards, not on the new and more efficient invention, magnetic tape. And yet, up-and-coming competitors like Eckert and Mauchly are building all electronic machines using tape to store data. Tom Watson Jr. gets that IBM will have to do the same or risk becoming obsolete. Hamilton, the engineer in this meeting, notices something else interesting in the newspaper article.
Eckert and Mauchly's company is backed in part by insurance companies.
What I would like to find out is just what the insurance companies need, and then we should go ahead and produce a machine to do the job for them.
Our men went over to Prudential and talked to the men there. We have a set of their specifications. I think we intend to do something on that.
We can't think and intend when other insurance companies are backing Eckert and Mauchly's outfit to build machines. We can't just afford to think about it and intend to. What is the quickest way to go ahead and build a machine to meet their specifications in the very shortest possible time?
The engineers can start by looking over Prudential specs.
If we can't build it, let's drop out. If we can do it, let's do it at a price those other fellows can't meet. It's an indictment against IBM to have those two fellas backed by those insurance companies.
Watson Jr. senses his father is uncharacteristically rattled. The data processing industry is pulling away from the old CEO. Prudential Insurance, which knows nothing about designing computers, has drawn up specifications for a computer that it wants. Insurance companies already surrender entire floors of office buildings to the storage of millions of IBM punch cards loaded with their customers' data. What are they going to do in coming years? Buy whole towns to store punch cards? No, they need a better way to store and analyze data. They see the answer to their needs in electronic computers and tape storage. The tension between father and son, past and future, is palpable in that meeting. Even if Watson Sr. is starting to grasp the potential for electronic computing, he still believes electronics represent a small experimental side business for IBM. He wants to move deliberately on this new technology and not cannibalize his own business. His son is more convinced than ever that his father's position on electronics could be fatal to IBM. Thomas Watson Sr. calls a group of his engineers, including Frank Hamilton, to his office. He'd just been down to the lobby at IBM's New York headquarters, taking a look at the somewhat electronic computer set up there, the SSEC, in public view. The conversation reveals how the old CEO has become fixated on the wrong things.
About that machine, I am worried about the dust. We should not have exposed all of that equipment to dust. We should have covered those machines and sealed it up.
Hamilton steps forward.
We did do that.
I saw the whole thing. The dust could get right into it. I think it's terrible.
I've been watching it. I've been down every week.
You should have been there every minute the men were working on it. Never mind what instructions you had from other people. You should have been there every day and all day. It was just left to a lot of workers and electricians to do as they please.
The question of dust is settled. Watson Sr. orders his engineer Hamilton to get moving on the computer to meet Prudential specs. Then, he takes the elevator downstairs for another look at the SSEC on display. It is a show, and Watson loves to put on a show. The lobby is full of gawkers. Even the sidewalk outside is crammed with people checking it out through the windows. As part of its public relations ploy, IBM announces that scientists can run problems through the SSEC for free, while commercial enterprises must pay $300 an hour, which is the cost of operating the machine. The point is to keep the SSEC running so anyone who looks in can see that it works. And it is running all the time. The SSEC looks sleek and impressive. Thousands of tiny lights flash on and off in no discernible pattern. Operators stand at desk-sized consoles in the center of the room and feed the SSEC information on cards, then watch the results print out. It's something like magic to the passers-by watching it work. It's a hit. Visitors give the SSEC the nickname Poppy. The New Yorker Weekly magazine features a cover story on the SSEC, and Watson Sr. gets the point. Computers excite the public. Whether or not they'll ever be a great business, well, that's another question. Yet the harder IBM drives toward electronics, the more Watson feels he's being shoved toward retirement. And he's not ready for that, even if he's long past the age most CEOs call it quits. So Watson puts his own survival first. He instinctively fights against both the new technology and any hint of succession. His most volatile reactions are aimed at the person who represents both technological change and a new regime at IBM, his son. By early 1949, Thomas Watson Sr. and Tom Watson Jr. have become like two open containers of gasoline. One little spark can set off a blast of harsh words, insults, yelling, and dramatic exits. On many occasions, father and son fight late at night, when Tom Jr. stays at his father's house in New York on East 75th Street instead of commuting back to his home in Connecticut. As they argue, Watson Sr.'s jowls shake. All the old family tensions come boiling out, and Watson Jr. lets his father have it with everything he's got. They fight in the office, in full view of other executives. One argument gets so fiery, Watson Jr. runs out of his father's office, bursts into another executive's office, throws himself on the man's divan, and sobs. After one heated meeting with a group of executives, they have it out.
You can't treat people the way you do, telling them shut your mouth, or if that's your best argument, keep it to yourself. Who do you think you are?
I might be stern, but I treat our people with respect.
Oh, come on. Your polite old ways of running a business are over. This is a generation that's been through a world war. You think they can't take some heat?
I believe in respect. In my day, everyone called me Mr. Watson. You want them to call you Tom?
Yes. Yes, I do.
And you insulted our engineering lab. It is the best in the world.
It's not the best in the world. It's falling behind. It's not even the best within 100 miles from here. Your SSEC downstairs might impress common New Yorkers walking by, but it's a technological dead end. The electronic components can operate no faster than the mechanical parts. It's not what customers want now.
I built that lab. I hired those engineers. They are the best.
They're antiques. MIT is graduating engineers who specialize in electronics. You know who's hiring them? Not us. They're going to Remington Rand or who knows where else.
You don't know what you're talking about.
A little at a time, Watson Sr. gives in. Father and son never come to any agreement concerning IBM's future with electronic computers. Both simply act. Watson Jr. runs ahead as hard as he can. Watson Sr. is clearly uncomfortable with the shift, but the old man increasingly stands aside and lets him go. This unspoken and perhaps unconscious mutual agreement will mean a great deal to IBM's ability to survive the transition from the older Watson to the younger Watson. See, the electronics revolution in computing allows Watson Jr. to not be his father, to be his own man, to renew the company his way. By the end of the 1940s, the U.S. military sees a conflict in Korea brewing. It wants powerful new computers to help it study atomic energy and develop jet engines. Watson Jr. sees his chance to get his father to approve IBM's boldest move yet into electronic computing. Every computer to this point has been a one-of-a-kind hand-built product designed to do specifically what one customer requested. The military is asking for 3 or 4 different computers, each devoted to a specific task. Watson Jr. and his young allies inside IBM propose designing a general-purpose computer that can be reproduced over and over in a factory, then programmed to handle almost any task. They know that if they can do this for the military, well, they'll wind up with a computer they can sell commercially. Watson Jr. takes the concept to his father, calling the machine the defense calculator, because the younger man knows the elder Watson will more than likely approve anything for the military. Watson Sr. gives his okay. Work begins on the new all-electronic machine. For the military, it will be called the defense calculator, but for businesses, it will be called the IBM 701. But by the time it's completed, it will already be too late. Because what no one at IBM realizes is that the RAND team is already making serious headway on a machine that will win the American popular imagination. A machine called the UNIVAC. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Business Wars. Next time on the First Computer War, the military helped build IBM and now the Justice Department is threatening to take it down. Standing in the wings is the possible beneficiary of all this, Thomas Watson Jr. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR, iHeartRadio, Wondery.com, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You'll find a link on the episode notes. Just tap or swipe over the cover art.
If you want to hear more of the First Computer War series right away, you can get the first 4 episodes of the series ad-free before they're released anywhere else by subscribing now to Wondery Plus. Go to Wondery.com/plus, that's P-L-U-S, You'll also get exclusive access to other Wondery shows, in addition to extra content and exclusive perks. You'll also see some offers from our sponsors, like Blinkist. Visit Blinkist.com/BW to learn more.
You know, another way to support us is to answer a short survey at Wondery.com/survey.
I'm your host, David Brown. Kevin Maney wrote this story. He's also the author of Unscaled, How AI and a New Generation of Upstarts Are Creating the Economy of the Future.
Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Sound designed by Bay Area Sound. Our executive producers are Hernan Lopez and Marshall Louie for Wondery.